from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's no strange fact to any of you that what's been going on here in Canada in the last little while is something that we're not used to. Most Canadians will sit back and watch the news, read an article, go on the internet, whatever, and hear about terrorist attacks, hear the term terrorism, hear the spin that some government people put on it, and still not understand it, because the old saying, if it doesn't happen here, we may be interested, but we may not care. Unfortunately, in recent history, Canada, although being part of a coalition with the United States and other allies, has not been that directly involved until members of our armed forces have been attacked and killed here in the last little while, most recently at Parliament Hill and in Quebec. Now, Waleed Chobat is no stranger to my program, although I have not had him on for a while. He used to be a radicalized Muslim and was a terrorist with the PLO. And I encourage you to go to his website at shobat.com, that's S-H-O-E-B-A-T.com, and learn more about awareness and action. Waleed, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, again, and I hope I preface the introduction properly, in Canada, and my audience is not just Canadian, it goes worldwide, but in Canada, this is something that we're not used to. We're publicized as a peaceful nation. Our Parliament Hill grounds, people like to play soccer on the front grass and do yoga exercises, and then all of a sudden, what some in the media will call a lone wolf, is able to attack a unarmed service member, kill him, and then get into the Parliament building. And, well, we know the rest from the media. And I bring you on as an expert in this to ask you the question about terrorism, the term terrorist, and what does it actually mean when someone is a radicalized Muslim?
Well, a terrorist means somebody who, through violence, wants to bring a political view and perspective through force. In other words, he wants to enforce his political view. You know, people ask, why do these terrorists want to kill us? You know, they just simply don't want to just kill just for the sake of killing. They have an objective and a goal. The first problem with the West, whenever there is a terrorist attack or a lone wolf, as you had in Canada, as we had here, even in Oklahoma, beheading even, is that they always, you know, listen to the media, which tells them continually, you know, whether this is linked to ISIS or this is linked to Al-Qaeda or this is linked to Hamas or this is linked to Islamic Jihad, or is there a affiliation link or an organizational membership link? And that's the problem. You have to look at the big picture. You know, ISIS doesn't only sympathize with ISIS, it sympathizes with other terrorist organizations. Islamists don't sympathize with only Al-Qaeda, they sympathize with Hamas. We've got to look at the whole thing as a network. And so when ISIS issues a decree in which they said, you know, in fact, I had the video, I have my computer opened up here to look at the article I wrote regarding the ISIS manifesto, in which the videotape is no longer, YouTube removes these things, of course, but I quote verbatim, if you can kill a disbelieving American or European, especially the spiteful and filthy French or an Australian or a Canadian or any other disbeliever, including the citizens of the countries that entered into a coalition against the Islamic State, then rely upon Allah and kill him in any manner or way, however it may be. And so is this instruction only for people who sympathize with ISIS only? You've got to take the word only out. Jihad sympathizers are jihad sympathizers. In fact, I probably was the first to translate some of this stuff from the ISIS manifesto, in which was caught on a laptop of a Tunisian ISIS member. But to me, this stuff is no foreign. It's all over in the Arabic language. It's not just ISIS holds this threat, or the declaration by an imam who gave a fatwa in Saudi Arabia. The ISIS spokesperson has posted a call to arms for Muslims around the world to kill Americans. But is he the only one that posted such thing? No, it's all over the place. So be it Canadian, European, or whatever, the coalition fighting ISIS is going to be avenged, and they mean it. And while the average Canadian or the average American, he got used to learning what jihad means, there's more shocking Islamic jurisprudence needed in order to understand what is at hand here, which circulates the social media to prepare Muslims to do indiscriminate killings of Americans and Canadians. In fact, for the first time, I'm the one that translated the stuff. It says, you know, that talks about what is called jihad radar, repulse jihad, or jihad tabyit, jihad by perfecting the killing methods. And here we enter a world of Canadians and Americans in slumber. Whether it's by naivety or whether by its design, the government isn't telling us what is spewing out in the Arabic and all over the Muslim and Islamist websites and social media. And so this is all over the place. In fact, it was a 26-page fatwa, which was issued by Nasr al-Fahd, a Saudi theologian. He's calling for a complete annihilation of the United States as well as Canadians. So it's not a problem for them to give the fatwas. And this is not a madman, because many will think this is just a mad guy who just is out to lunch. No. Right. This is the top jurisprudence, and he's in prison currently in Saudi Arabia. But this is not a small jurisprudence who's giving this. Quote, he says, "Peace, mercy, and blessings of God. It is no secret what was published in the media about the intention to hit America with weapons of mass destruction. So what is the fatwa ruling for the Mujahideen to use these? Is it permissible at all? Is it the mother of necessity? This issue needs a complete message and gathering from evidence and scholarly sources to the question regarding the house of war, what Islam calls Dar al-Harb, and how to practice jihad ud-dafa, which is repulse jihad, and the meaning of destruction of crops, including reproduction of life, children, religiously, and so on, which I will collect what was given by Allah's will." This is from page 2. I know, just translated excerpts of it. And then he goes on to say that infidels cannot be repulsed from the Muslims except by resorting to using such weapons. Then it may be used even, which is weapons of mass destruction, may be used even, killed and wiped out completely, every American. You know, so we have to think very seriously about those threats.
Now, Walid Shobetz here, you used the term slumber. Why are we guilty of that slumber? Is it the government? Is it the media? Is it that we just... I don't think it's the part that we just don't care, but you're right, that is such an accurate term, especially here in Canada, that we kind of are lulled to sleep and we're not seeing the whole big picture.
Well, they do not like to address issues that causes panic.
Right.
You know, all governments, police systems, FBI, what do you have there? I've dealt with the Canadian intelligence too in searching for, you know, people. They really don't want to alarm people. That's number one. Number two, some of it has to do with, you know, especially in the U.S., you know, with the liberal mindset. You know, there's many killings that happens that they make it just a regular crime. They don't want to attribute it to Islamic issues because they don't want any repercussions in which people can go kind of crazy and begin to kill and retaliate. If you recall 9/11, it was a bunch of Sikhs that were killed.
Sure.
Why? Because they had the biggest turbans in town. So they went to these gas stations, began to shoot Sikhs. Mm-hmm. And I was going like, are you crazy? Sikhs, big turbans? They don't like this Islamist movement themselves. So there's confusion, and they don't want any kind of, counter Lone Rangers doing anything. So they have this fear, and they don't want to spread it, and they're afraid of all kinds of mistakes. That's why they like to have the FBI or the professionals to deal with it. But the problem I have is they do not translate these issues, and especially when this kind of stuff is really accompanied by a litany of training material. I mean, the training material. Everybody who's listening should look at the manifesto, the ISIS manifesto. Put the word ISIS manifesto on Shubat. And you can see the training videos in which, plagues the social media, especially YouTube, in which you have the training of how to make RDX, Simtex rockets, rocket launchers. And we have it from series number one to series number 81, how to make the rockets, the launchers, the whole thing, even including how to make the chemicals necessary from fertilizers. And if you can't get the chemical fertilizer, you can make it from regular manure. And they show you how, the Naqshbandi Sufi method of how to make, explosives. And we're talking about high explosives. And they show you everything, So there's these hundreds of videos galore to train Muslims who are overseas or who are in the Middle East, anywhere, to use these materials for causing destruction. And even the beheading that happened in Oklahoma,
Right.
It is pretty clear. They talk about how to, there it is, the quote from the manifesto. It was shown in Sahih Bukhari, which is the top authority, in explaining the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad. The Prophet said, Allah wrote everything we need to know about ihsan, kindness. So now you understand that Islam has what it's called kindness in killing. So if you kill, perfect your killing. And if you slaughter, perfect your slaughter. And sharpen your blade and comfort your sacrifice. Hadith Muslim, number 107-13. And so this is not some maniacs who are coming up with this stuff. This is coming from the highest jurisprudence in Islam. And so the government does not want to discuss, how do we address this issue? Because it does really hit the core of Islam itself. It becomes such a politically incorrect issue to deal with that it's very, very embarrassing. They don't want to offend the moderate Muslims and so on and so forth, or say that Islam has to be dealt with. And that's been the biggest problem. And so the examples are given, the methods are given, the techniques are given, the mechanism of the training is given, and it's all over the Middle East, and the Muslim world is known even in English here. But nobody wants to say the emperor is naked. And so nobody discusses it. That's why I am the first one in the world who comes up with litany of issues and stories and facts, which I translate from the Arabic language, and I show the whole world, videos, you name it, and very rarely they question my research. And so, to me, it's alarming that the government isn't telling the people the reality of why it's happening. In fact, before the incidents in Canada and the U.S., I wrote continually saying, it's coming, it's on the way, here's the stuff, before that. This manifesto I'm discussing with you,
right,
was written and published before what happened in Canada, telling them what's going to happen.
Yeah. Waleed Shobatz here for a few more minutes. Social media, you've touched on it, we've discussed it. This is something that, I don't know, maybe I'm using the term impossible to control, but it is definitely a sounding board for the terrorists. What about social media? Should there be stronger controls?
Absolutely. In fact, how many times I've published articles showing the training videos and the manuals and even writing in the articles, here, Mr. Reader, click. And I have a pretty, flamboyant blog. I'm probably one of the top, anti-jihad blogs in the world. And I say, here it is. Click FBI.gov. Tell the FBI to have YouTube remove these training videos. And guess what? Nothing ever happens. Now, in YouTube, my son, he he likes to talk and shows YouTube about the homosexual agenda. He doesn't like the homosexual agenda. Within 5 minutes, YouTube will, you know, remove the account, cancel the account, and remove the video, just for criticizing the homosexual agenda. You know, it's not stuff like, hey, go kill homosexuals. It's stuff about exposing that there's an agenda the homosexual has, and that gets removed. There's no freedom of speech when it comes to YouTube. And so, but when it comes to issues like this, of telling the American people, look at this training manuals, look at these things, this has to be removed. They absolutely doesn't do nothing. The FBI does nothing, and nobody does anything. In fact, at one point in time, this was last year, it was some different country police department that called finally and kind of shaked some, you know, rattled some feathers to remove a video. It was nearly impossible to move these videos. So I think who was at fault is YouTube. You know, YouTube is major complicit when it comes to issues like this. And this is going to come out in the future. I can guarantee it. In the future, when these things become prevalent and goes in high gear, then they will pay attention. This is the problem. They won't pay attention now. They always pay attention, you know, way later after the fact. And this is the problem.
Absolutely. Final word, Waleed. Joe and Mary Smith sitting in their living room in Oklahoma or in Saskatchewan, Canada, and they want to know what they can do to help protect themselves, their family, their country. What would you tell them?
Well, in Canada, you have a problem. In America, you know, there's lock and load, you know.
Right, yeah, exactly.
You have problems in Canada with bare arms, unlike the United States, so you're really in a bad situation. So there is no other situation, no other solution, but just to basically be ready. You know, I enter in a plane, I look, if there's Muslims in the plane, 25 students from Yemen, I am very concerned. I profile. All the things that tell you you should not do, you should do. Profile. Look at the forehead. If a Muslim male has an imprint of a forehead because he prostrates his head on the ground, he wants what is called zabiba, which is an imprint. And because the Quran says the mark of their faith is on their foreheads. If he's shaven, it's a problem because a Muslim male cannot shave his beard. And you have to look at the mustache. If the mustache is trimmed and the beard is elongated more than the mustache, then he is very likely to be a Muslim fundamentalist. And if he's shaven with an imprint on the forehead, then he is up to no good, usually. It's not, you know, ironclad. But those are the things that I used to teach to Homeland Security, which basically, since Islamic discussions has been prohibited, it's becoming politically incorrect, we can't discuss those things. They never even teach that to TSA and all these people.
Gee.
And this is something that we need to do without political correctness. And so people need to be aware, you know. They say, he's a nice doctor, I trust him. No, you know, you just don't trust anyone unless you know them very well. And so, you know, people could be lured into being killed. And all the girls who are listening, you know, you fell in love with Prince Charming Muslim, understand that there are laws, and if you marry somebody who's Muslim, you can go to any Muslim country, they can prohibit you from going to your country. You can kiss your country goodbye, then you realize this program was correct. But it's too late, so you need to be careful, you know.
Waleed Shobat, always a pleasure. The website is Shobat, Shoebat.com. Hope to have you on again soon. Thank you, sir.
God bless. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Waleed Shobat, former terrorist. He was a radicalized Muslim. He tells it like it is. I'll take some criticism for having him back on the show again. But I think it's education that we all need. I'm Dana Pretzer. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. One of my favorite guests in the program is Mike McIntyre. Of course, you know Mike as a justice reporter with the Winnipeg Free Press. He's the host of the very popular Crime and Punishment radio show on the Chorus Radio Network and the author of several Canadian true crime books. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Hey, good to be here. here. Always happy to touch base.
Now, you know, normally we're talking, well, we try to stay on topic with Canadian stories, and but the Americans seem to take over with that, but not these last few weeks. It's been crazy as far as Canadian crime news, and you've been very busy with it, I'm sure. Let's start with the sentencing of the shooter of the Moncton RCMP officers and the sentence he received.
Yeah, Justin Bourque, many listeners, I'm sure, recall the story. It actually happened earlier this year. This is one of those rare cases, Dana, where the Canadian justice system actually moves very quickly.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why we can't move this fast on other matters. I guess part of this was because there really was no trial. There was a very early guilty plea and an early sentencing. Many listeners may recall Justin Bourque, the Halifax man who went on a rampage, gunned down three RCMP officers in cold blood, was arrested after a manhunt that really paralyzed the whole city of Halifax and, in a lot of ways, I think, terrified the whole country of Canada. Bourque was a cop hater, and he was out for blood that day. He was just going to kill anybody in uniform. And unfortunately, three proud RCMP officers lost their lives. What's really remarkable, though, about this story is, as mentioned, that Bourque, there was some indication in the early days that perhaps he was going to be trying to argue that he was not criminally responsible, that he was suffering a mental illness. There had been some bizarre online rants in the days preceding this, and some indication that perhaps his head was not in a good place. I suppose you could say that about anybody who would go after authority and gun down innocent people. In Bourque's case, though, he waived any fight that he could have had on his hands, and he did something that almost nobody does, and that is plead guilty to the most serious charge in the criminal code, first-degree murder, cold-blooded, premeditated murder. And even more remarkably, Dana, there was no plea bargain. We often hear that term thrown out there, a plea bargain. But the Crown, in this case, gave up nothing. There was no incentive. There was no deal. And by pleading guilty, Bourque exposed himself to some new sentencing laws in this country and ended up feeling the full brunt of what I'm sure American listeners will say it's about time, and that is a new form of sentencing when you commit more than one murder in this country. In the past, you would get a life sentence, but your parole eligibility for first-degree murder would always be set at 25 years, and that didn't matter if you killed 100 people. You are always going to be eligible for parole after 25 years because it would be served concurrently. Now, under new sentencing guidelines, the parole eligibility can be served consecutively. And so Justin Bourque last week was given a life sentence with no chance of parole for 25 years times 3 for each of his victims, so 75 years. You do the math, Justin Bourque, who is 24 years of age, would have to somehow survive in prison to the age of 99 before he could even so much as apply for parole. So it's safe to say, Dana, that at least since the abolishment of capital punishment in this country back in the 1960s, this is the harshest sentence that's been given out to any Canadian criminal. And it is as close to a true life sentence where the offender will, in fact, guaranteed die behind bars that you can get. And I think most Canadians' reaction to it is good riddance to Justin Bourque.
Absolutely. There's a special place that he'll end up. Mike McIntyre is here. When we talk about this, and of course it won't bring back the three brave officers in Moncton, we continue on with the attack on Parliament Hill and the attack on the service member in Quebec. It looks like some are calling it terrorism, some are calling it not. A little later on in the show, I'm going to be interviewing a former terrorist to get his opinion on what terrorism really is. But what about this? A Canadian service member, two of them, dying on Canadian soil. That hasn't happened.
It hasn't, and separate attacks by individuals that it's now emerged, Dana, were clearly suffering from all kinds of delusions. You know, in the case of Nathan Cirillo,
soldier who was gunned down guarding the war memorial in Ottawa in a case that made headlines around the world. In the case of his attacker, the man who attacked him has been described as a homeless crack addict with sort of a history of delusional behavior. He himself, of course, was then killed inside Parliament in what was an absolutely heroic act by the sergeant-at-arms of this country who then gunned him down and perhaps spared many others from losing their lives that day. There has been a lot of debate, of course, about whether these two attacks, the hit and run in Quebec that resulted in death, and then this ambush at the war memorial, whether these are symptomatic of you know, terrorist ideations in this country or a movement, if you will. I think for the most part, what's emerged in the days that have followed is that these were two, certainly people with terrorist beliefs, but nothing at this point to suggest that they were acting as part of some grand conspiracy or operation, that these were isolated, albeit horrific, individual attacks that have obviously struck at the core of this country, and I think put everybody on guard in a way that we weren't just a few short weeks ago. But at the same time, I think it's important to always look at the facts and perhaps not make this something that the evidence at this point doesn't suggest that it is. And, you know, I think going forward, you're going to see renewed vigilance, and we're seeing that already, beefed up security everywhere. We know, of course, these are very sensitive times we're living in with what's going on in the world. And I think what these incidents have shown is that we're not immune on Canadian soil. Maybe there was a complacency among some Canadians to think that this wouldn't happen here. Well, you know what? It does, and it did happen here, and it could happen again, and everybody's got to be on guard.
You know, it's interesting, the image, I guess, of Canadians that were nice and things like this don't happen, and gun control and you name it. And now that it has happened, and these people, these members of the Canadian Armed Forces and the RCMP and whatever have lost their lives protecting us, now we have to look and feel more vigilant and tighten up security. But those will say, some will say, Mike, that, well, I like going to the Canadian Parliament buildings and practicing yoga on the front lawn, and how dare they take away my Parliament buildings from me. Will we really wake up and tighten things up here, because these lone wolves are out there preying, and who knows when the next one will attack?
Yeah, I mean, time does sometimes breed contempt or complacency, and I think, you know, the longer, I suppose, we go away from these incidents, perhaps the more people fall back into their old ways. Of course, in the immediate aftermath of the Cirillo attack, it was going so far, Dana, that all military personnel in this country were actually being told not to wear their uniform.
Yeah.
Unless they were on duty, and not to wear it in public, which, for anybody in the military, I mean, that is an absolute affront to everything they stand for. And, you know, I think that's been relaxed because, again, in the aftermath, there was all kinds of reporting. The day of the incident, as tends to happen these days in the world we live in of social media, I mean, there were unconfirmed reports of other shootings and perhaps other suspects being out there. And as you say, it ended up being one sort of radicalized lone wolf. But, you know, I think as time goes on, we probably will start to go back to the way it was, but I don't know if things will ever be the same, because I think these incidents have left such a mark on the public, and certainly for those on the front lines, whether you're police, military, you know, working in any form of government that could be targets, I think it would be a long time, if ever, before life ever truly goes back to the way it was.
Crime reporter Mike McIntyre is here. Let's talk a little bit about, we did last show, Luca Magnotta. The trial continues. What's going on there?
That's a good question, because I cannot believe that this trial is taking as long as it is.
Yep.
I still, and I've been following it very closely, have no idea what anybody's doing here. For a case that really is supposed to boil down to just simply criminal culpability, criminal responsibility, that is, was Luca Magnotta mentally ill when he killed and dismembered and videotaped and sent body parts of the victim all over the country? Was he mentally ill or not? That's the issue for the jury. This should have taken a few days, and yet here we are, weeks and weeks of testimony. The poor jury in this case has been forced to hear and see some absolutely awful things, including the video, photos, everything. And I just don't know what, I don't know what the Crown's doing. I don't know why they put all that in when that doesn't really play to the issue. I'm not exactly sure what the defense is now doing. They're calling evidence, and I guess their own psychiatrists and people who had dealings with them. It just seems like everybody has gone out of their way to actually make this as big a spectacle as possible,
yep.
Which is probably exactly what Luca Magnotta wants. This
exactly.
is a guy who, just by the very nature of how he committed this act, was trying to get his 15 minutes of fame, while justice officials in this country are making sure that those 15 minutes are well into overtime now.
Yeah.
At some point in the very near future, the defense will rest, and the jury will be left to consider the expert testimony, and I suppose tune out all this other stuff that really doesn't relate to that sole issue of what was his state of mind at the time of the killing. I mean, it's been fascinating to watch, but I'm just not sure at the end of the day what the whole purpose of it. I keep going back to the biggest criminal responsibility case that I've ever covered, and one of the biggest in this country, Vince Lee, the Greyhound bus beheader.
Right.
Awful facts, not unlike the awful facts in Magnotta. That trial took 2 days, not 2 months. And, you know, that's because there were all kinds of agreements made. They narrowed the issue down, and they focused the testimony solely on that issue. That has not been the case in Magnotta. They're doing everything, it seems, to be counterproductive to narrowing down the issue, and they're dragging it out as long as possible.
Yeah, and Luca Magnotta is loving every minute of it.
Absolutely. He's, for a guy who, you know, every Canadian knows his name, and it's sad. I bet you if you did a poll, more Canadians know his name than the name of the poor man that he killed. And that's often the case in these cases. This is exactly, you're playing right into this guy's hands. And I think the quicker he just disappears from the public spotlight, the better.
Our justice system is, again, innocent until proven guilty. But we have a thing going on here now. It's hard to put a term to it with a former CBC radio personality who has been accused in the public forum of rough sex, sexual assault, so to speak. The Toronto police are investigating it. You're a media guy. You're a crime guy. Have you ever seen anything like that in this country?
Well, it's pretty scandalous, and it's growing, it seems, by the day, because every day, today again, we were hearing of another victim, this time a male, a man who's come forward and said that he was molested by John Gomeshi some 20 years ago. But we're now seeing, and this often happens in sex assault cases, especially ones where there are many victims, in that usually all it takes is that first victim or two to come forward, and it tends to, I guess, create enough courage and confidence for other victims to come forward. So you're seeing that snowball, that domino effect now. Where this stops, who knows, because we're now dealing with potentially a time span that maybe goes back a couple decades and involves male and female victims. And yeah, Gomeshi, who sort of tried to get out in front of this story as soon as he got fired from the CBC by doing a very public Facebook post that I think he's now going to regret,
yeah.
Where he put this out that this was just sort of a jilted ex with some bogus claims about consensual sex, that she's now changed her story. Well, we've quickly learned, Dana, that this is, the allegations here go far beyond a so-called jilted ex. I think we're now up to about 9 potential victims, 3 who've come forward publicly and put their names to the allegations and have gone to the police. I would suspect that maybe not in the next day or two or week or two, but I think you're definitely going to see criminal charges coming as a result, and it may be a long time before we realize the full scope
Yeah, it's a huge story and one with a lot of questions yet to be answered. Mike McIntyre is here just for another couple of minutes. What's next for you, my friend? You are always busy.
How's 1 week from today, Wednesday, November the 12th, is actually the launch of my next true crime book. I actually just got it back a couple of days ago from the publisher. And this one's a little different for me. This is my sixth true crime book. The first five that I wrote were all on specific criminal true crime cases that I personally had covered. This new book, which is called Mike on Crime, True Tales of Law and Disorder, is actually 16 different short stories, all true crime stories, all cases that I've personally covered over what is now close to two decades. It'll be two decades this coming spring. So I went back sort of over my career and picked out not just the most serious or the most newsworthy, but sometimes the more quirky stories. There's a mix of real heavy stuff, real light stuff. And each chapter, there's 16 in total, is its own self-contained true crime story. So we're having the big book launch in Winnipeg on Wednesday, November the 12th, 7 p.m. at McNally Grant Park in Winnipeg. The book will be available in bookstores, I think, you know, in quite a few Canadian cities, also online, of course, through, you know, things like Amazon and McNally Robinson and Chapters and Indigo. So Mike on Crime, True Tales of Law and Disorder, for any true crime buffs out there that maybe want a stocking stuffer or something coming up for this Christmas. It's a fairly light read, and as I say, there's 16 individual stories, but some I'm very proud of and sort of takes a look at some of the more notorious and memorable cases of my career.
16 stories over 20 years. You've got another 20 years in you, I think.
It's interesting because I'm about to turn 40. I was one of those very lucky ones. I started my career at a very young age. I had just turned 20 when I got my first full-time job at a Canadian newspaper covering the crime beat. So it's interesting. Come this upcoming spring, I can say that I'll be 40 years old, but I'll have spent exactly half of my life covering the crime and justice beat. So absolutely, it's something that I continue to have great interest in, and we'll see what the next two decades bring.
And there's a new story every day.
There is, absolutely. Just when you think you've seen it all, something else comes along to change your opinion about that.
Absolutely. Mike McIntyre, good friend, host of Crime and Punishment on the Chorus Radio Network, and a justice reporter for the Winnipeg Free Press, and get out there and get that new book. Thanks, Mike.
You bet. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Mike McIntyre, a good friend of the program. And we wanted to touch on some Canadian issues because there's been lots to talk about lately. I'm Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. One of my favorite shows on history is Ice Pilots. Mikey McBrien's been on the show before to talk about it. Of course, Buffalo Airways is a long historic airline that flies out of the Northwest Territories. It's been 6 years that this docuseries has been on history in Canada on Wednesday nights at 9 o'clock. Mikey, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hearing, and it's been advertised that this is the last season. How come?
Yeah, you know what? It was a long run. You know, six episodes on Canadian television is amazing. You know, for us, it was about time. You know, season five, if anyone remembers the last episode, was kind of almost a goodbye episode.
Right.
Coming back, we thought, hey, we'll give her one more shot. We'll do one more season, really for the fans, and so we approach it as the final season, and because you know, television is the horrible C word. No one ever wants to hear that. So we just want to go out on a high point and you know, be very proud of the product that we released.
And you're right, six seasons and anything in television is something to be proud of. Did you ever think that it would go this long when you first started?
No, when we first started, like, I was fresh out of college, and yeah, no, it's just been an amazing ride, and it's been wild, and the last 6 years feels like four lifetimes to me. It feels like I've been doing this for a long, long time. So it's I'm very proud of it. You know, we're going to have a total of 73 episodes. So that's a lot of stuff that we put out there.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. Mikey McBrien's here from Ice Pilots and Buffalo Airways. Last time you were on the show, we talked about it a little bit, how the show is actually made, like when we see an episode, how much video actually goes into that. What's the typical filming schedule for a 30-minute episode?
They're actually, it's an hour episode, but it's a long time, you know, because we're not scripted, we're not coerced into doing anything. It's basically a fly on the wall. So they could film for weeks and not get a single, you know, minute of television, or they can get two episodes in one day. It's just, we just never know. And then that's the beauty part of it, and I think that's why we've lasted, you know, six seasons, because it's you know, it's fan-driven. It's the people that watch the show that make the show. So they we relied on ourselves to have interesting stories because that's what we do. And it was put into in a way that was organic, and hopefully that comes across on TV.
Yeah, I apologize. Of course, it's a one-hour program. Mikey McBrien's here from Buffalo Airways and Ice Pilots. You know, just sitting back and watching the opening episode with this, you know, the problems with the C-46 and the engine fires and all that sort of stuff. Is that a typical day at Buffalo Airways?
No, definitely not. like I said, we film for weeks, and if everything goes perfectly, you know, it's bad television. No one really wants to watch, you know, like a corporate video. You know, a lot of shows become corporate videos, and the beautiful thing about Ice Pots and Buffalo Airways is that it's raw. And if there's something that happens, we're 100% transparent, and we put it out there. You know, there's a lot of companies that they have marketing teams and stuff to spin things and to, you know, hide stuff. The beautiful thing about us, we're just a bunch of guys from Hay River, and we just lay it all on the line.
Well, for listeners and viewers here in Weyburn, Saskatchewan, of course, Arnie Schrader, a legend with Buffalo Airways, is from here. And when we sit back and we watch the program, especially here in Canada, Mikey, we've got that feeling of, I'm not sure what it is. It's kind of a, we like seeing the personalities, your dad, yourself, your brother, all the characters that are there. What about who we see on TV? Are you the same Mikey we see on TV when you're not on TV?
yeah. And to put that in perspective, if you're, like, we film basically from October to June. So there's a camera around you all the time, and if you were to, like, act or put on a persona, you'd just be exhausted. So, like, maybe, like, the first 20 minutes of being filmed, you're kind of, like, watching what you say and kind of whatever, but it's just, you just get caught up in the thing, and the cameras disappear. So what you actually see is actuality of how we are. Sometimes it's edited to a point where, you know, it's only interesting stuff. You're not going to see me eating supper or something, but they do take the gold nuggets out of everything. But it's definitely an accurate representation of the family structure and how Buffalo is.
I'm guessing that your dad, when this started, wasn't a fan of the cameras being around. Now, 6 years later, is he going to miss them?
You know, because it's about the people. You know, when you're being filmed, there's a person behind the camera, and they become part of the family, because all the crazy stuff you do, they're with you. And on television, they're invisible because you're looking through their eyes, the cameraman, right? So you get to miss the people. And so you lose, like, with the show being done, you're almost losing, you know, half your family members of the production side of the company. So that's kind of sad, and I think that's what he's going to miss the most.
A favorite episode, a favorite season. It's probably an unfair question for me to ask, but after 6 years and this year, of course, there's more to go yet, but has there been a favorite?
You know, I've been doing a lot of press and stuff, and that's a pretty popular question, and sometimes I answer it differently for everybody, but the honest thing about that whole thing is that is a whole, and, you know, it's almost like, you know, not like a cop-out answer, but to see the story arcs and all that stuff, because it is an episodic thing, but actually it is life, and if you watch it and you watch the whole structure, that's what I like. I see Ice Pilots as one big episode because that's how life is. And that's all together, all these amazing experiences, I can't really, you know, put my finger on one because they all lead up to each other. It's like a big web.
Yeah, for sure. Mikey McBrien's here from Buffalo Airways, and of course the very popular Ice Pilots, which is in its final season on History Wednesdays in Canada at 9 o'clock. What about that final day? I know when I've had TV folks on before and asked them about the final episode, they always answer, well, it really isn't a final episode because we shoot parts here, we shoot parts there, and then they all tie it together. But how difficult do you think that final day will be?
You know, we're done. We're done filming and everything now. And if you, the season finale, see episode 8, because we're just doing 8 episodes this year, there's one moment where I'm basically laid on the ground all rolled up into a ball because, you know, the situation of what that episode is, I don't want to give any spoilers out. But that was the last moment. I know that it was like the climax. And sure, there was a little bit of sit-down shoots and that kind of stuff. But the last real day of filming for me was probably the most exciting day ever. So I had a really good, you know, last day. So hopefully everyone will enjoy it.
So you've had the TV bug. Of course, Buffalo Airways is your life. What about Mikey McBrien in the future? Will we see a spinoff?
Well, that's what we're working on right now. And, you know, I've taken a lead with Buffalo right now, and I trained a really good guy to replace me so I can pursue what is next. You know, the television game was really about 50% of my job at Buffalo Airways. Almost as a go-between, because you have the production company and you have the airline, and I was always stuck in the middle. And so once the show was gone, like basically half my workload was gone as well. So that's what we're working on right now. So I'm working directly with Shaw and Omni Films, and we're trying to figure out what can we do next that will be fair to the fans. And it'd be very easy to, you know, make a really crappy spinoff, which everyone's done, but. You know, The Simpsons is the most popular spinoff ever, and because it came from the Tracy Ullman show. So you just kind of look and see what's going to work, and I don't know yet, but hopefully soon you'll see us back on television somehow.
You know, and that's great, and we just have a few minutes left with Mikey here to talk about television and the Canadian production, and of course, Ice Pilots is Canadian. Ice Road Truckers, I guess, a little bit too, but we don't see a lot, and the folks at Shaw and others should be commended to keep that Canadian aspect when it comes to television. What about your thoughts, Mike, and when it comes to TV, you're competing with that American market, but then again, you're part of that American market.
Yes, that's a very, very, very good question. You know, Ice Pilots cannot get more Canadian. Apart from our theme song, basically everything else is 100% Canadian. So I'm really proud of that, and I'm really, really proud of Shaw to take a chance on us to do that. And, you know, there's some really great Canadian content out there, and, you know, throughout the board, not just Shaw, but a whole bunch of other channels.
Sure.
And it's up to the public. The public wants to support Canadian stuff. You know, the networks will make Canadian stuff, and I'm very proud that we're a pretty good example of that.
Well, I tell you, it's 6 years. It's a very entertaining, sometimes grab the seat of your chair type of program that we all enjoyed watching. Kudos to Buffalo Airways, yourself, Mikey, your family, your dad, everyone there, and congratulations on 6 great years with Ice Pilots, and continued luck, and hopefully we'll be in touch soon.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, Saskatchewan's been amazing. You know, a lot of people come up to visit the hangar and everything like that. You know, luckily your Rough Riders colors are very similar to Buffalo Green, so it just mixes in quite well.
Right on. Great. Thanks, Mikey.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Mikey McBrien from Ice Pilots, the final season here on History Channel in Canada, 9 o'clock Wednesdays, and look for Mikey maybe in something coming up soon. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.